Mental health for first responders today, unfortunately, is in crisis. And we've been spending the last 3 years talking about all the things that police need to do better without spending enough time, I think, looking at what are the reasons why some of these things need to be better, what can we do to help, and what are police doing really well. And today, I bring my friend Jay Lacayo onto the podcast because Jay has been a police officer for the last 19 years. He's an avid exerciser, he coaches high school football, and most importantly, as far as the purpose of today's show, he participates in a not-for-profit where he helps first responders reclaim their mental health and get back to living a life of freedom without compromise. We get into a lot of the ways that Jay became who Jay is and the ways that he and the not-for-profit he works for help these first responders. I hope you enjoy the show. I hope you check Jay out. And if you have the opportunity to, also, the not-for-profit Jay, what's it called one more time?
Reps for Responders.
Reps for Responders. Let's get to the show. Jay Lacayo, welcome to the Active Life Podcast,
man. Happy to be here, man. Thanks for having me.
I'm happy to have you here. I know you more as the athlete who was coming to flex events back in the day when I was putting them on all over the place. Man.
Some time ago.
It is some time ago. But I've seen that your life and your work has seemingly picked up a really interesting purpose that I'm really excited to chat with you about because it's something that it just seems so needed in our public service space. And we'll get to it in a second.
Yep.
But what we're talking about is the mental health of first responders and the idea that right now suicide's at an all-time high. Guys and gals need help, and I want to get into all of that. Before we dive into all of that, I have a belief that I'm starting to form, and I'm curious your opinion on it because I love listening to the way that you speak whenever I hear you talking on I don't know if it's, is it your own podcast that you're talking on Instagram?
Yeah, it's my own podcast. Okay. We just rebooted, got into a new space, and we have a production company that kind of does all our stuff, so it's pretty dope.
Let the people know what it's called.
It's called Behind the Mic. We're actually in the process of changing the name, and it's around mental health, but we get people from all walks of life, and we kind of just go through their journey on how they became the person that they are and what obstacles they got over to get to where they're at.
So So if you guys go subscribe to Behind the Mic, whatever you change it to, it will just be the one that pops up on your feed and you're like, what is this podcast?
Yes.
It'll be the one you used to listen to called Behind the Mic.
Yep.
Well, that leads me perfectly into my first question then, because I think one of the beliefs I'm starting to form is that for someone to have the capacity to learn how to be a great mentor, I think they need to have experienced three things in their life. One is significant loss, whether that's physical, emotional, or mental, doesn't matter. They need to have had a really deep down.
Yep.
Two is resiliency. They need to have come back from that so they can teach from the scar, not from the wound.
And I like that.
Thank you. It's not mine. I don't know who I stole it from, but it's not mine. And third is they need strong purpose. Because one of the things that I've learned, at least for myself, is without strong purpose, you can be pretty effective, but it gets tiring.
Yes.
Burnout hits. So I'm curious your thoughts on that as you've interviewed people who've experienced loss and rebounded from.
Yeah, I've experienced loss on many levels, and I think that is the catalyst for change.
Loss? Right?
Loss, yeah, man, because I feel like some people have to endure some type of suffering to either want to change or either remain in that space. And most people, in the face of adversity, will do either or. They'll either face it head on or they'll try to run from it. And what I've learned in my experience was that I wanted to face it head on. And it was an uncomfortable space for me. It took somebody who cared about me to tell me, hey, man, you're not the same person I knew. Something about you has changed. It was a combination of things. It was some personal life stuff and the job. And, you know, I always use this analogy where life is like being in a fight, you know what I mean? And it's like a 12-round fight, and your corner crew is like your support system. So if you have a therapist or a close family friend or something like that, people that are looking from the outside and can kind of see what's going on. Because when you're in the middle of this fight, you might think you're winning, but you're getting your ass handed to you, you know? And if you're like me, I always want to push forward regardless if I'm getting beat up or not. And so one day somebody sat me down and was like, listen, dude, like something's not right. So they put me in contact with a therapist, had a couple of conversations, very uncomfortable ones, and started to unpack a lot of things that were going on in my life, some past and present stuff. And that was the beginning of the change, you know, and from that point on, I started to work on, you know, self-improvement and started reading like a lot of like self-help books and self-actualization stuff. And that's what brought me to where I am presently. You know, I was in a very, very, very low spot in my life, and I was able to kind of pick it back up.
Were you lacking the awareness at the time that you were in a low spot? Was it just like, this is just another day, push forward, we're going to get through this?
Yeah, because that's what you're taught, man. You're taught to just kind of like push through, you know what I mean? Just be tough, mm-hmm. you know, wipe your pants off, get up and keep going forward. But you can only do that for so long until you have to address the you know, the elephant in the room. Mm-hmm. And I had gotten to a point where I think I was just so numb from just constantly like pushing forward, because especially in police work, you know, you go from one call to another call to another call. You can't really relish on that first call that was probably horrible for you, because that's like the beginning of your day, right? So you come, you know, you have a, let's say you get a, you go to a motor vehicle accident, and you know, there's three people in the car, you know, very, very, very bad accident. Maybe somebody passes away, right? So, I mean, you know that, all right, well, this is just the beginning of my tour. I got to keep going. So you kind of just push through, and that's how it leaks into your life the same way.
That's interesting. Who did the person who told you you're not the guy I know you to be, who did they have to be for you to hear them?
Oh, somebody I used to work with. She was like my big sister. Okay. And had a tremendous amount of respect for her, because, you know, she had really took me in when I was working with her. I was a lifeguard at this pool years ago. And we just bonded. We had very similar upbringings. And, you know, we just bonded on that level. And then one day I saw her, right? Randomly, I'd become a cop. I'd been a cop for some years. Hadn't seen her in a while. I think the last time I saw her was her wedding. And we were having a conversation. And she just noticed something different about me. So then she was like, hey, listen, just from time to time, give me a call. So I would call every so often. And it's funny, because I think she was kind of doing her therapy thing while she was speaking to me. Mm-hmm. And slowly but surely, she's like, listen, I'm going to give you someone's card. I want you to go sit down and have a conversation with her. She's a good friend of mine. She's a therapist. I think you need to go in there. And I was like, you know, right away, you automatically get defensive. Mm-hmm. Or you think I'm crazy. It's not that I think you're crazy.
Did you say that to her?
Yes. Okay. Because that's the stigma, right? You go see a therapist because you're crazy. Yeah, yeah. Something's broken. Wrong. Yeah. She goes, no, I don't think you're crazy. I just think you're changing and not for the good. So I was like, okay, you know, you're somebody I respect and I hold in high regard. So I went in there, had that conversation. And the first conversation is like the most awkward one, because you're literally sitting there and my body language was saying, I don't want to speak. I came in there, arms folded, just not really engaged. And she starts asking the right questions. Mm-hmm. And then I'm giving her the responses, and she's like, mm. And the one thing that I hate in conversation, especially in this line of work, before you become a police officer, you have to sit down and take a psych eval. And part of the psych eval is an oral eval. And while you're talking, this person just jots things. And she did that. And I was like, oh, man, I must have said something. Mm-hmm. So then automatically I start to come back. And she's like, no, listen, this is just my notes. I don't want you to think you said or did anything wrong. But just know I'm going to be jotting some things down. So a few conversations like that, eventually you stop worrying about people writing things down and then you kind of let things out.
What was your self-talk like about the friend who made the referral right after she made the referral? Was there a moment of distrust? Was there a moment of resentment? Like, what was it like in that moment?
It was a split second of distrust. Split second, real quick. But then I realized that this person has always done the right thing by me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my default emotion is usually like anger, right? So I was angry right away. And then I just realized, like, this person has never done anything in my life to hurt me. If anything, she's done things in my life to help me. So I was like, all right, cool. What's the worst that could happen? Somebody tells me that I got some trauma from some past experiences. And I realized, I was like, I've been doing this a long time. And I became a cop at a very young age. I was 22 years old. Mm-hmm. So at 22, I don't even think I was emotionally developed to see the things that I've seen. Or even in a spiritual sense, ready to handle the things that I was going to see. And now I was doing it for a certain amount of years. So all that just compounds. And then you realize one day that, damn, I've seen a lot of messed up things. I've seen a lot of messed up things before I was a cop. But I think when you go to work 5-6 days a week and you see it every single day, and then you don't sit down and say, hey, maybe you need to slow down and just relax a little bit. Because you're constantly, especially with police work, you're like always on the go, man. And you're working these crazy hours. You know, you're working a midnight shift where like there's certain parts of the night. If you're really tired, you get a little delusional, man. Like if you work the double and now you have to, you know, you're the second part of your shift is at midnight, you're beat up mentally and physically. So I think in the beginning it was a little distrust, but like I said, she always kept me in a good space. She always cared about me. So I knew like, all right, something going on here, and I need to address it.
From an outsider's perspective, it sounds like the shift work of policing and the unpredictability, whatever the word is,
yeah,
that fits there, contributes,
yes,
to mental health issues. It also feels like something that should be very simple to control. Why don't we have a better system for that?
It's hard to have a checks and balances, man, because everybody goes home to different situations and circumstances. Not every person goes home to an ideal household. You have to now take in, because the workspace that we work in is extremely toxic. You have to think about this, right? You go to work and you deal with the public and you're always the bad guy. Once in a blue, you save a kid or you do something that is viewed as heroic, but more often than not, you're giving tickets, you're arresting people. It's just, there's a lot of ebbs and flows to the job, but you're dealing mainly with toxicity and even your coworkers. Some of these people don't have the self-awareness to be empathetic to some people. And it's like, you know, it's, I always say being a police officer is like being in a frat. Mm-hmm. You know, it's smiles, it's laughs, it's jokes, but there's a lot of like harsh comedy. There's a lot of morbid mm-hmm. jokes, and you just don't know who's dealing with what. So it's layered. It's very layered, so it's hard to have a checks and balances.
I was recently hanging out with Bruce Cardenas. I don't know if you know who Bruce is.
No.
But he does a lot of private security detail for celebrities. And he was a lead marketing team member for Quest Nutrition and now for Legendary Brands.
Wow.
But before all of that, he was on the LAPD, and he was there for the Rodney King riots and things of that nature. And he said he spent time prior to that working as a U.S. Marine on security duty for important people.
Okay.
So when he would go out on patrols and see guys who are normally getting in trouble, not getting in trouble,
yep,
he would go play with them in like a, hey, I bet I can do more push-ups than you.
Yeah,
kind of way. So that when something did have to happen and they had to be there for those guys would trust him more, be more open to talking to him, not be so resistant to all of that. And one of the questions I didn't ask him that didn't occur to me until you just used the word empathetic about policing is, I imagine having empathy as a police officer is both extremely valuable to the people you're interacting with mm-hmm. and potentially detrimental for your mental health. Because you're going to distress calls all day.
All day.
And so empathy is being able to put yourself in somebody else's shoes and understand how they feel and want to be treated in that moment. That's a lot of feeling distress all day.
Yep.
So how does anybody balance the need to have it to be great at their job and the risk of having it of their own mental health?
Yeah, I mean, police culture has changed a lot. I've been a cop for almost 19 years now. In the beginning, no one ever asked, hey, how you feeling? No one ever did that. It's starting to change now. I went to a call, and not to be like graphic or anything, but it was an infant who had passed away. I'll put it to you like that. And I remember the same exact call at 23 years old. Now I'm 38, and I experienced the same call. It was two different human beings, right? So young Jason in my mind, that wasn't real. That's how my body processed that trauma. Mm-hmm. It's just like a movie. 23-year-old Jason was like, that's not real. Now we fast forward to 38-year-old Jason or 39-year-old Jason when it happened. My brother had just had my niece, so I had held her, mm-hmm. and I had a connection. And I think that was the difference. Like me holding something that was it was an extension of me. Like I'm holding this baby. Looks like my mom, right? Mm-hmm. Looks like my brother. So now this is like an extension of me. So the emotions that I had holding my niece for the first time was amazing. So now I hand them back to my brother. I hand her back to my brother. And a week later, I go to a call, and it's, an infant that passed away. And that was the first time in my police career where someone was like, hey, man, are you good? You need to speak to somebody. And there's just a range of emotions that in that particular call, because that first call that I had was just dead baby in a bag. So, we had to open up the bag, make sure. Mm-hmm. So you see it, and it was just like not real. But the thing that shook me about this particular call was the baby was handed to my partner, and the baby looked like it was sleeping. And then if you know your partner, right, if you work with somebody every single day for years, you notice body language and you know, all right, this is either good or bad. And I remember, and this guy was he's a medic full-time when he's not a police officer. I've seen this guy bring people back from the dead, man. He's a phenomenal medic. I've learned so much from him. And when I'm telling you, this lady handed him the baby and his whole body just deflated. He was like, dude, just drive. We'll get to the hospital. His baby's been dead for about 2 to 3 hours. The baby had a little bit of rigor, some lividity. And I just remember going into, and it's funny because we mentioned traumas. I remember going into this specific hospital. So I've been there for 17, 18 years, right? And there's always this room that they bring people in. And there's two rooms. So it's one to the left and one to the right. And they automatically went to the right. And that's how I was like, you associate the right or the left room with death. And so now it really sets in, the baby's dead. And I just remember every emotion running through me, but I had to be stoic because now the mom's coming in and she's going through every emotion you can possibly think of: rage, anger, denial, you name it, it's in existence. And there's a trigger phrase that they tell us not to say in the academy: relax. I told her to relax at one point, and she went off. So then at that point, I just removed myself and had my partner kind of deal with that. And when I'm telling you, that call didn't hit me till 3 days later. I'm driving home, and then tears just start rolling down my face. That has never happened to me in my career. But if you look at police work, it's like, oh, man, you got to be this tough guy. You got to be this macho guy. You know, it's unacceptable to cry. So when you build up this, like, machismo, this bravado, that you have to constantly be this guy, shit gets tiring, man. Mm-hmm. And so now I've noticed in policing that, they offer peer support programs. They offer, hey, a therapist. They never did that before. That was never a thing. But now it's more acceptable. You don't have to worry about, being rubber gunned where they take your gun away and then you're sitting on a desk. There's a period of time where you got to sit down. They'll tell you, listen, take some time off of work. But, it's more accepted now to sit down and have those conversations and put you in rooms with people who are empathetic to what you've just been through and will get you the services if need be.
Well, it sounds like the culture is starting to shift. My question would be, are you seeing that first responders, police officers or otherwise, are adapting to that shift in culture, or are they resisting that shift in culture?
No, they're definitely adapting to that shift, only because the job's getting younger. Mm-hmm. The older relics, as we like to say in police work,
right.
Like the command staff or the brass, they're from an old genre, but now that genre is starting to turn around. You got people my age who are now captains, chiefs, and so on, who notice that policing is changing. So I think they're more accepting to that change.
So what was it like for you? And I won't ask you to speak for others, but I think that it could probably be extrapolated to others. From 2020 to 2022, it seemed like all we were hearing about was how terrible the police are when you're doing everything that you can to hold your own shit together.
Yeah.
When you're seeing people go through difficulties who you badly want to help, who are then turning around and saying, you're a bad person, we should pay you less.
In my whole career, that was probably the roughest time, hands down. Going to calls and being vilified, like, immediately was something that I had to get used to.
What's an example of being vilified? What does it mean to show up at a call and be vilified?
You show up to a call where there's clearly someone in distress. So I'll go back to a vehicle accident. And this particular call, somebody ran into a light pole. So we're using extrication tools to get in the car. And
they
then
ran into it hard.
Huh?
So they hit it hard.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so we have, like, Hurst tools, and we're, like, prying the door. We're spreading the dash. We get two of the victims out, and then you get bystanders just coming over. What are you doing? Why are you? And we're just trying to render aid. Mm-hmm. But that had been the new norm now. The minute you go to a call, first thing you want to do is shove a camera in your face. Instead of you calling 911 or doing something productive, you're shoving a camera in our face, and all we're trying to do is render aid and get these people to a hospital. That had been the new norm for us, going to calls and having people just disrespect. It was just ridiculous, man. I've never experienced anything like that in my career. Not saying I've been a cop for a super long time, but I mean, 19 years is a decent amount of time. I know guys that have been on the job for 30, 40 years. So for me, like, 20 is, I'm still, I'm not the new guy, but I'm not the vet. Right. And I just never experienced it, man. It just wasn't something I was accustomed to.
Does it make it harder for you to do your job?
Yeah, because it makes you second guess a lot of the things that you do.
What's the risk of that? In other words, when I ask that, I think that people who perhaps think you guys aren't doing your job well would be like, maybe you should be second guessing, Jay.
Yeah, I mean,
and I'm not saying I'm one of them. I'm just asking the question so they can get an answer.
The tough part about that is that when you second guess yourself, you see, in this line of work, if I second guess, I could die. Or my partner could die. And that would weigh heavy on my conscience if someone got hurt on my watch. I have a great deal of pride when it comes to that. I'm the guy, when I show up to a call, people are like, all right, Jay's here. It's cool. Like, we got it under control. When you second guess yourself in this line of work, it could potentially be fatal. And that's what you don't want. Because, you know, a lot of these kids now that are hired, they're very tapped into social media. And what do you see when you go on social media? It's like, you know, cop shoots suspect, and then, you know, you find out 6 months later the guy got fired. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's a good shoot. The guy was indemnified, but, you know, maybe some political something or other happened, and they wanted to make an example out of this person. So, especially with someone like me who was in that tactical space, where, you know, you're taking the door at 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. And in those hours, someone's coming through your door. I mean, nothing good can come from that.
Especially not at the sound you guys are making.
Yes. So, you know, some people will lay there, or you might get somebody who may go grab something or may come out of a room with something in their hand. So that plays a role in it as well. So I knew. I said, listen, man, I don't know if I can be in that space anymore. It's just too much liability on that point. When all I ever wanted to do my entire career was be like a SWAT guy.
Right.
And so when you have someone like me who was gung-ho, now starting to see the shift, saying it's time to get out of here.
And what I think is interesting about that, and sad in a lot of ways, is I imagine you were always the guy, once you became, and we can discuss that in a second maybe, once you started to develop the empathy and become the mature adult, you were the guy going into those rooms who was trying to keep everybody safe.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't going in there looking to kick somebody's ass and get your rocks off because you can do it with a badge.
Yep.
And now you're the guy who's saying, I can't do this anymore because there's too much liability. I don't want to be a part of it. That's a loss for everybody, the department, the community, and even the criminal, because they're going to be safer if you're in the room than if someone who's maybe more trigger happy, less mature is in the room.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with this job, you have to mature. And I feel like if you don't, then you have the potential of getting yourself into a lot of trouble. And also, it's like a physically demanding job, but not also is it physical, it's mental, it's spiritual, it wears on you, it just grinds you down. Mm-hmm. And so you need to have the wherewithal to be like, listen, I need to A, do this, B, do that. You have to figure out a plan of attack, because if you don't, then you could potentially end up in a bad situation. And you know, I never looked at it like that, like the community losing an officer like myself in that space, because I'm very empathetic to a lot of things because I come from an environment where I have family members who are on the other side of the law. So I understand how things can be viewed and perceived. So I usually try to come in. I'm always middle line. I never come in, too far, left or too far right. I'm always the guy that's right in the middle because I understand what it is to be on, the other side, because I've had people who have interactions or family members and they come to me and they ask me, well, yo, why'd they do this to me? Why they do that to me? And it gets you upset sometimes when you hear these stories of like cops doing things to people. And I don't know the circumstance because there's always three sides to a story. There's, their version, the cop's version, and the actual truth. And so, I don't want a Monday morning quarterback anything, but I always try to be as middle line as possible because I don't want to come in too hot. I always come in on a one, and if it needs to go up, I'll go up. But I always try to stay real like baseline.
What led you to getting yourself involved in the mental health of other first responders?
Great question. I had gotten to a space where I wasn't happy with who I was. And I knew there were other guys struggling with the same thing. We just had this unspoken code that we couldn't talk to one another about it. And so I said, let me be the first to be that guy to like openly talk about going to therapy and doing those kind of things. And I think once I started to do that, there's a few other guys that I work with like, hey man, did you really feel like that? Yeah, dude. Like, and then when they realized that, so I don't think people view me as like a mentally weak person. Mm-hmm. So for them to hear that I went through it, I think they were like, oh man, if Jay went through it, then I know it's acceptable for me to feel the way that he felt. I think there's a lot of cops that feel that way. They just don't know where to go. So at least if I'm the example first, and maybe you can come to me, have a conversation, I can refer you to somebody. But I was in a space where I was having like suicidal ideation, and that is definitely not me. And once I was able to get over that hump, I said I got to be the guy that changes this for everybody else.
How do they know they can come and talk to you before you got involved in this not-for-profit that we'll talk about in a second? And let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. I imagine you're not walking around the police station saying, yo, I want everyone to know I just got to have a therapy session. It's great. So how does it start to come up?
Believe it or not, man, my social media was a big catalyst for that. People were watching my stuff and listening to me, and they were like, dude, I never knew. Like, I always walk around as this jovial, happy person. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going through something, you will never know, because I was always taught to kind of just, power through it and just make sure nobody knows how you actually feel. And so I think my social media was jump-started that. I think a lot of people are like, hey, man, I listened to this podcast that you were on. And, you spoke about some things that I've experienced or I felt. I didn't think it was normal. Mm-hmm. Then I heard you talk. And they were like, okay, cool, man, like, so maybe I'll, and it would always start with like a text. It was never like a conversation in the locker room. Mm-hmm. Or in the building. It was always like, hey, you busy, bro? Hey, what's up, man? What's going on? Because I always tell people, I don't care what time it is. Call me, text me. If you need me, I'll get back to you. And when I get up or if I'm up, trust me, I'll hop on the phone. It started out as like small little text conversations or like a DM. And the next thing you know, we're sitting down somewhere having coffee, just talking about what they're going through. I think it starts there, like casual conversation. Mm-hmm. Then eventually what I try to promote now is, hey, let's get together and do something uplifting instead of going to a bar and having, alcohol. Because there's two things that you're supposed to avoid when you experience a traumatic situation, and that's caffeine and alcohol, because it affects your REM sleep. That's how our body processes trauma. And so for like 72 hours, you're not supposed to have either of the two. Interesting. And if anybody knows police work, alcohol is a social lubricant as well as coffee. Mm-hmm. So you go through a, you know, mass casualty incident where you see multiple things, and first thing we do is go to D&D or Starbucks and do like what they call a hot wash about the call over coffee. It's not really conducive to what we're trying to do here, right? We're trying to heal. Mm-hmm. And so I try to create a space where we can sit down, have a conversation, and not have alcohol, not have caffeine, maybe move our bodies, maybe do something in that space, maybe do some breath work, something like that.
And guys are amenable to it?
Some guys, not all, right, but some. But you got to start somewhere.
Right.
You know, if you don't start somewhere, you never know where you could potentially go. So usually you use a few people as like the example, like, hey, this guy was doing breath work, he's normal, or, you know, he meditated, he's normal. Because I think a lot of people view that as like, I don't know, especially in like police work, right? I don't think they view it as macho if you're meditating and you're doing breath work. Mm-hmm. You know, lifting weight is a whole nother story. There's a little machismo behind that. Right. So that's probably viewed a little bit differently. But if I told somebody, hey, you know, initially, like, hey, man, you meditate? I'm like, what do you mean? Like, sit there and do this? No, man, just some guided meditation, get an app and have somebody give you some prompts and you're breathing. And people used to laugh at me. Mm-hmm. I got guys that are like, hey, man, I did that. It worked. Right. I use Headspace now or whatever it is.
Could even just be going on a walk with no headphones. It doesn't like, that's for me, that's how meditation started.
Yep.
It started as I can't and don't want to sit down, keep my mouth shut, mm-hmm, and let thoughts go in one ear and out the other, and then decide which ones to observe.
Yeah.
But I can go for a walk without my headphones and just focus on the breath hitting my upper lip, and that's it.
Yeah.
I can do that.
Got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
Right? So I always tell people, you know, I used to get on my bike, and that I can go 60, 70 miles on my bike and just go. I would just listen to the air just whiz by my ears. And that, to me, was so calming. Mm-hmm. And then changing geography. Like, I can go from one place to another, look at a river, look at some mountains or whatever, just get my mind off the world, and I wasn't glued to my phone. You know, I think we have to detach ourselves from all this stimulation, because I think, you know, a lot of people, first thing they do when they wake up in the morning is roll over, grab their phone. And then that to me jumpstarts your day, depending on what you see. You can see something negative, especially with like police officers. There's always something somewhere about some cop doing something. Now you got to see that, and then it starts your day. Then you're dropping F-bombs and feeling some type of way to start, you know?
You know, I never used to subscribe to that idea, that checking your phone in the morning is a bad idea.
Yeah.
Especially first thing. And then as my following started to grow, and I say things that people don't always agree with. Mm. And so I would wake up in the morning and have fistfights in my comment section.
Yeah.
And in my DM, people just coming at me telling me I'm an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, whoa. Hi, I'm Sean. Nice to meet you. And I realized I cannot, should not wake up and check that.
Yeah, man. That, and because like a lot of stuff that you post, it's your opinion, right? Mm-hmm. And if someone doesn't know you, then they're automatically going to judge you based off of some of the things that you say. Say, I know you. I've right. had conversations with you. So I know when you speak, I know where it's coming from. Mm-hmm. But there's somebody across the world or across the country that's looking at this and going, hey, who does this guy think he is? And then now they're just firing shots at you. So is that the first thing you want to do when you wake up in the morning? No, man. Like, you know, I want to get my life together before I even tap into that space.
Yep.
You know, so that's why I have this like ritual every morning. I got to wake up and do these things to align my chakras to make sure that I go out and I have a productive day.
What are your things?
So I wake up every morning, most mornings, a meditation session, and then I do some light journaling. So I have like a gratitude journal. Mm-hmm. And I kind of just start with what I'm grateful for. It could just be simply waking up that day. I could write that or whatever else I feel like writing. And then I start my moral report card. And then I go over like a Bible verse and then a quote of the day. And then I start my day. Then I move my body.
How long does that whole thing take?
Depends on the day. No more than like 35 minutes.
Okay.
So it's 35 minutes out of a 24-hour day that sets me up to win.
Right.
I've noticed the days I don't do it rougher than the others.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I recently started a gratitude journal again. I hadn't had one for a really long time because I got to the point that I was like, I'm thankful for fresh air. Like, this is stupid. But so I got to the point now that I'm like, I can actually be a lot more introspective than I was before. I was just tied up in like, I got to win. So I don't have time to do this. I got winning to do, which didn't result in winning.
Yeah.
Right. But, and I have found that it allows me to, it takes off a very light layer of weight early in the morning.
Yeah.
Like it's, if you're listening to this and you're like, I've tried gratitude journals, it didn't help me. It's like, well, first of all, do it longer. And second of all, it's not supposed to lift the weight.
Yeah.
If you've ever like bench pressed, it's somebody just putting two fingers and tapping the bar.
So it's just a spotter. That's all it is.
That's it.
Yep.
It's not, they're
I like
not.
I like that analogy a lot.
Right? They're not two-handing it.
Yeah.
It's just tap, 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 tap. Got it.
That's it.
So look for that. You get into working with police on mental health. How has that impacted you personally, first of all?
It's impacted me in a way where I'm able to give back to my community, the guys that I work with. Mm-hmm. One thing I think people don't realize is cops are human too. I've seen guys go to calls where they've seen things and cry. And they're not doing it in front of 20 of us, but like you see a guy kind of turn his head and when you look at a big burly figure and then all of a sudden you see his body language change, it's like, hey bro, you good? And everybody tightens up. I'm good, man. You know, there's a little wipe. But I know firsthand that I've helped people because they have told me or they have, you know, brought me in front of a family member and be like, hey, listen, what you've done for him has helped. And that to me is more gratifying than anything else. I think I do a lot of the work that I do for the respect of my peers because, you know, they always talk about this blue brotherhood. It's, and you know what? Sometimes we're our own worst enemy. Somebody goes through something, everybody turns on them. You know, I've never been the type of person to try to be that person. I've always try to be a guy who's there for people in need. I mean, that's why we take this job, right? To help. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we have a problem with helping our own community. We're better at tearing each other down than we are building people up. So I wanted to leave my imprint on my community by just being able to give back and say, hey, listen, man, it's okay to not be okay. Mm-hmm. You know? You can't be Superman every single day. Even Superman had kryptonite, you know. So,
how much of the I'm a cop. I go to a scene. I see something horrible or something that, you know, isn't horrible to everybody else, but it's horrible to me because it hits home.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, I get emotional about it. We don't know who the person is who did it yet, or we do. Doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
The next call I go to, or the next 20 calls I go to, seeing the perp who did the one before in the person at all of the next calls. Is that a thing that happens or is that something I'm just making?
No, it happens. It happens. Some people are triggered by certain things. It's very hard to have convenient amnesia on this job because humans are emotional creatures. And sometimes you don't know that you're emotional until you actually go through it. And so you get triggered by certain things. Like I know there's certain people who go to certain kind of calls where they're like, hey dude, I'm going to take a backseat on this one. You already like, so I know that this is doing something to this person. It's making them feel a way where they say, and they're very A type. Cause this is an A type personality job. This A type person is like, I'm gonna take the backseat on this one. Then I know, okay, cool.
What would be a reason for that? Like what would an example and why that would happen?
Like some people with domestics.
Okay.
So like you go to a domestic and, you know, that's some of the roughest stuff you go to because some people have grown up in households where domestic violence was prevalent. Mm-hmm. And you see some people either have a very, very aggressive response or some people have a very docile response. And when the docile response tends to be the person who was probably like the young kid who saw it and couldn't do anything. Mm-hmm. And there's still that young kid, you know, when they go to this call, you could see him, like body language is everything. The body language will tell you exactly what's going on. And like, they'll come in and a person that I know that's like running to calls and now does this and kind of looks and goes, hey, listen, I'm gonna be out here. I'm gonna be talking to this person. I get it, no problem. And I go and I kind of take care of business. Mm-hmm. It all depends on like what you've experienced.
Okay.
You know, but I know some people, domestic violence is a lot more prevalent than I think people really think, because I don't think a lot of people talk about it. Now, whether you grew up with your parents screaming, that's a form of domestic violence, or, you know, you've seen somebody put hands on someone else in the house, that's a whole nother form of domestic violence. It's there's layers to it, and I think that some people don't realize that that was domestic violence until they're in the academy and they realize, oh shit, well, you know, my mom's boyfriend used to punch her, like, you know, but they're like five, so they can't do anything, so they don't know how to deal with it. So that would be an instance where someone kind of takes a backseat, or you get somebody who's like wants to save the day, mm-hmm. comes in as a hard charger. Sometimes we don't need that, because now you're going to escalate the situation. It's like throwing kerosene on the fire. You know, you're only giving it more fuel to get bigger. So sometimes you have to say, hey, listen, buddy, I got this. Take a back seat. You know, why don't you get this information from this person?
How is screaming domestic violence?
So verbal abuse.
Okay.
You know, if they're screaming to say, hey, take the trash out, that's one thing. But if they're calling you a lazy piece of...
Right.
And then that's like the thing. Because like my mom can say my name in a way where I still do this. And I'm 41 years old. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So I've seen people go to calls and, you know, someone gets emotional and like bashes their hand on the table. And you could see it. It's like now you see them... whole body language changes. So there's different forms of domestic violence, because I think people only believe that when you strike someone, but verbal abuse probably has a lot more weight than physical abuse. Mm-hmm. A lot more weight.
Yeah. I recently, twice actually, heard Bedros Koulian give the same talk in different ways. He did a very good job. And he talks about, sometimes I wish my father would have just hit me, because then I could have just gotten over it. Oh no, yeah. It wasn't Bedros. It was Ben Newman.
Okay.
And he was talking about, I wish my father would have just hit me, because then the bruises would have healed. But it wasn't that. It was words, and it was lack of love, and it was feeling inadequate and not approved of. And so
I can relate to that.
You can relate to that.
Absolutely. Like my father was always like, would never give me compliments. And if it did, it was like in a roundabout way. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a huge reason. I didn't even find this out until I went to therapy. Right. And, you know, a huge reason why I used to suffer from imposter syndrome. Like, I was always a really good athlete. Like, I was always one of the star players on whatever team I played on. I always excelled in that area. I was always known to be, like, very charismatic. I would do, like, these small plays and be like, oh, my God, he's so great. He's this, he's that. But I would never get that from my dad. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, the main reason why I became a police officer was to please my father. I didn't realize this. You know, I had other dreams and aspirations, but I grew up seeing my father in a uniform, and, you know, it was either military or police work for me. But I think, you know, all the accolades and the things that I've done in my career, I was never given that, hey, son, I'm proud of you. And so it goes back to, I think my dad's only hit me like three times in my entire life. All three devastating. Like, and I deserved it, mm-hmm. rightfully so. Because I was a little bit of a knucklehead when I was a kid. So sometimes you need somebody to tighten you up and mm-hmm. kind of keep you in place. And one of my proudest moments in my life was when I graduated from the police academy. And like in a roundabout way, my father told me he was proud of me. And that's when I was like, okay.
How'd he tell you?
He goes, listen, man, you know, I was a little worried about you for a while, but you got through it. Great job, son.
Okay.
That was it.
You played football, yeah?
Yeah.
So the podcast that actually came out today, I went and interviewed Steve Weatherford. I don't know if you remember him, punter for the Jets and the Giants. And
jacked.
Yeah. So it's interesting that you talk about your father that way. He said one of the most down moments in his life, won the Super Bowl, goes over to the sideline, grabs his 5-year-old son out of the stands, and his son says, Daddy, I want to be a pro athlete just like you. And he's like, most people would think, amazing. My kid wants to be like me. I just won the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
But all I could think is the only way I know how to help him become me is to give him my childhood.
You don't want to do that.
And he's like, and I didn't have a good childhood. So the next 8 years, we spent him hating me, me resenting him. It was a really interesting thing to learn from him.
That's heavy, man.
Yeah.
I could relate to that. You know, I don't have any children yet, but I don't know if I don't want to make it seem like my dad wasn't a good dad because he was a phenomenal father. I just think, you know, in certain spaces, it's almost like Marvel, right? Mm-hmm. And every superhero has like 99 strength, 99 this, but they lack in certain areas. And I just feel like my dad, the emotional intelligence mm-hmm. wasn't as high, you know? So that's why when I coach, I make it a thing to like tell kids like, hey, you did great. You did this, you did that. Now, when they did something wrong, I'm going to tell them, but I'm going to put a lot more emphasis on the things that they're doing well. Because I didn't notice this until recently. I've been coaching high school football I coached for like 4 years, took a little hiatus. And I just came back. This is my second year in a row coaching. And I would notice kids would like, you know, make a nice little run and they'd get up, dust themselves off. And the first place they're looking is in the stands. And then I see these parents at every single game. And they were looking for the approval of their parent. And there were some kids who were on that team where their parent wasn't there. So then I had to step in and be that guy and be like, listen, man, great run. Or listen, yeah, you got down the field on that one. You covered your bases. Great job. I felt it necessary because I was the person that was looking in the stands for my parents. And they know what they know. They can't teach you something that they don't know. They knew to work hard and provide, you know, food, shelter. And, you know, they didn't make it to all my games. You know, I've had some pretty dope games and other parents were like, oh, this kid's amazing. But, you know, my parents were working, mm-hmm. you know. So I make it a thing to make sure that I let my kids know, like, hey, man, you guys are doing well.
Hey, I think that's really cool. And also, I think Steve would describe his childhood similarly. Hmm. He said on the show, you know, he had a great dad. It was just he was a Clint Eastwood dad. There were not a lot of words.
Mm-hmm.
There was not a lot of approval. There was not a lot of love. It was just dad's there, and you know what dad is there for.
Yep.
So you learned about that in therapy. You didn't even realize that until you went to therapy.
Yeah, I didn't realize that at all.
So how did you allow yourself? One of the things that when my wife went through some postpartum mood disorder after our last kid, and we decided together that it would be a good idea for her to see somebody. And one of my fears, straight up one of my fears, was that they were going to tell her, your husband's a big part of your problem.
Oh, wow.
I don't know why I would have that fear. It's totally irrational. I do everything I can. Like, my relationship with her comes first.
Yeah.
But that was the fear. Yeah. Like, you hear about therapists, you hear about experiences like that. They're going to tell you, the fear is they're going to tell you, like, hey, this is a relationship in your life that we need to visit. How much of that did you come to on your own? How much of that was dropped there for you as a look at this? What do you think?
Yeah, I never knew that my dad was like a big part of why I view myself the way I do mm-hmm. until I went to therapy. So I had no clue that he was a part of anything.
Did she tell you though, or was she asking you questions and you came?
She was asking me questions, and then one day she was like, listen, this is probably like, I'm like 6 months in. Mm-hmm. She goes, I think your dad is... plays a role in why you think the way you think in some things. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, really? She says, yeah. You seek your father's approval. I don't think your father's ever told you that, like, you're a good guy, you're a good person. You know, I think a lot of people don't realize what they have in front of them, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, I look at my dad's relationship with his father, and that was, like, a little estranged, you know, and they were very similar, so therefore they butted heads. But my father would always talk about my grandfather in such a high regard. And I only knew my grandfather as this version, you know. Right. I didn't know my grandfather as a young man. My dad grew up with him, like, in that space. He was a completely different human being. So I think that played a role in how he treated his kids. You know, he had two boys, you know, my older brother, myself. And I think, you know, he taught us right from wrong. Taught us the things that you're supposed to be taught, you know, how to have accountability, but He lacked the, you know, he'd say, I love you, son. You know, he'd say that. But I just think, like, after a, like a game or like, you know, you missed a game winning shot or something, sometimes it's just like, it's okay, son. It's all right, man. Like, I'm still proud of you. Mm-hmm. You like to hear that kind of stuff. I mean, I know, like, for me, that's what I wanted to hear, but I never got that. It was always like, toughen up, and there was no crying.
Right.
You know, so I wasn't, I'm still to this day not a big crier because of that, you know, because it was almost like, what you crying for, man? Like, you know, toughen up.
Right.
That's the way he was taught. So they can only teach you what you know. But I didn't realize any of this till several therapy mm-hmm. sessions, and she pointed it out. She goes, don't be so hard on yourself. You know, you've done some monumental things in your life. You know, take some ownership of that and understand that, you know, it's not easy to get to where you're at in life, and you've done well. Maybe you don't need his approval.
I imagine that's common amongst men in general. You know, the less that we're taught to be, I think there is a line between being emotionally intelligent and available and being soft.
Yeah.
There's a line there where it's like, hey, man, you're allowed to tell me how you're feeling.
Yeah.
I want to hear how you're feeling. I want to be here for you. If you keep coming to me telling you how you're feeling without ever seeking a solution, whether it's immediately or on a timeline that makes sense for you,
yeah,
then you're just complaining. How do you parse that when you're dealing with mental health amongst police officers? And the reason I ask that in particular is because my brother-in-law is a cop.
Yeah.
And he seems very well balanced.
Mm-hmm.
He does. And I know other police officers who seem very well balanced.
Yeah.
And I know other police officers who I'm like, dude, I would not want you coming to help me. Like, I want someone coming. So if it's got to be you,
so
let's
do
it. But if we could get somebody else, could I call in a request? You know what I mean?
Do a little swap here.
Right. Because it's just the negative, 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 negative. Like, whenever I hear a guy talk about, I know my retirement date and it's this many days away.
Yeah.
I'm like, that, for me, that's a sad thing to hear.
I know why guys get like that. Because of the change in the landscape. I don't feel that way. I'm not giving them more than 20. Like, whatever my time is, that's what I'm doing, and I'm getting the hell out. Mm-hmm. But I can see how somebody can get to a space like that, because I don't think they hate their job. I think they hate how they're treated, mm-hmm. you know, because it comes from so many different levels, man. Like, you have micromanagement, you know, from the command staff. You have internal disruption from, like, your coworkers, and then you have your personal life. You roll that all up into one big ball, and that makes your life very shitty on a day-to-day basis. And I think the people that you speak of that are balanced, I think they have a way of allocating that energy and doing other things, you know, going for walks, exercising, having a hobby outside of the job. Mm-hmm. I noticed that when you ask police officers, hey man, like, what do you do? Or, like, tell me something about yourself. The first thing they lead with is their job. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying, I'm a father, or I'm this, I'm that, I'm a coach, whatever the case may be, is they lead with, I'm a police officer. And this is one of those jobs where you come in and it can literally dominate your life, because you have to have a certain kind of mindset. And then, you know, you work in a space where it's almost like us against them mm-hmm. type of mentality, when you have to rectify that, because we are them, you know. Not everybody thinks that way, but you have to have that kind of mindset, because I always say, when you take off that uniform and it stays in the locker, that's where it should stay. You shouldn't take your job home with you. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's easier said than done, because you go to a crappy call, and, like, obviously your family's going to see that you're not, you know, your jovial self or whatever. And they might ask a question that might be a trigger point for you. Mm-hmm. Hey, I don't want to talk about it. And you get, you know, reclusive, and you just kind of close up and just, like, you know, leave me alone. I want to go sit by myself. You know, you're allowed to be in that space to feel that way, but at some point you should probably talk about it, you know?
I think that's a common thing for anybody in any profession. The difference is perhaps the intensity and the nature of what's occurring at work, the mm-hmm. idea of bringing it home. One of the things I ask people to do, in fact, who I mentor, is designate a place in your house you don't go to often. And anytime you want to talk about work with someone else in your house,
yeah.
you have to both be in that spot. Because
I like that.
That energy just stays there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're not thinking at the dinner table about work. You're not thinking at the kitchen counter about work. You're not on the couch thinking about work and getting ready to vent it.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, does this rise to the level of we need to get up and go to that spot? I got to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to forget that the other person has to take that burden too when we share it with them.
That mindset a lot, man.
So being respectful of them,
yeah,
hit that spot. I want to just talk for a moment about when you describe you're also leaving it when they get their 20. They're not getting more than that. There's a difference in, again, the intensity of I'm putting in 20 years and then I'm out.
Yeah.
And knowing it's this day, I have this many hours left on the job. Because the difference is you're focusing on doing the job until it's no longer the job. That person's focusing on when they can stop doing the job.
Yes.
Which means when they're on the job, my brain goes to they're not thinking about the job.
Yep.
They're thinking about the end of their shift that day.
Interesting insight.
It's just the way that I think about it.
Yeah.
So what is the not-for-profit that you work at? Like what do you guys do? Is it a not-for-profit?
Yeah. It's called Reps for Responders. It was started by this young man named Frank Vos. A phenomenal young man. I feel like I say young man because I'm 41, about to be 42. He's like 27. I feel like he's lived five of my lives. And, you know, he struggled with some alcohol abuse. His father was as well an alcoholic, and they were both able to get sober and, like, straighten up their lives. And he has made it his life's mission statement to help those who went through what he went through. And he had come on my podcast, and we spoke about suicidal ideation, and off camera we spoke about how we both were at that point. And that's a guy I look at, and I'm like, damn, man, this guy's a resilient, strong person. And for him to sit there and say that he went through the same ebbs and flows of emotions that I went through and got to a point where he had a plan, you know what I mean? And I was like, wow. And so I said, listen, dude, whatever you need from me on my end, I'll do. And then we've been kind of running around since 2020. We have a podcast called Inside the Labyrinth, which is run through Reps for Responders. We've interviewed a lot of amazing human beings. Brian Shaw, Josh Bryan from Jailhouse Strong, Matt Chan. I mean, the list goes on. And, you know, it's all geared around mental health and helping those in this space get services and, you know, put them in a position to win.
What does that look like? Putting them in a position to win.
So they sponsor like gym memberships. They get people therapy if need be. They can get you in line with like a nutritionist. Obviously, he's had a discounted rate. He has like a staff that he works with, and they have like a resident nutritionist. And she, her name is Dani Tochi. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but yeah, she does some nutrition stuff with us because it's giving people the tools to improve their life. A lot of people don't know where to go, and they need a start point. We're just there to provide the start point, and if you choose to continue to stay with us and work with us, you can.
Well, what you're talking about there sounds similar to what we were discussing before, the men's health and women's health is doing.
Yes.
The strength and diversity initiative that they're running with. The idea of we're not going to give you a handout,
mm-hmm.
but we're going to provide you all of the tools that you could possibly need to pull yourself up.
Yep.
You know, the idea of I used to ascribe to the notion of, you know, we're all dealt the same, like we all have the same opportunities, put the work in. But the reality is we don't.
Nope.
We only have the opportunities that we have the education and experience to be aware that are in front of us. And so while we might all have the same 24 hours in a 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we might all have the same legal system and all that to operate within, if we don't know somebody who's done what we want to do, the top of what we're going to aim for is the top of what we've seen.
Yes.
And so what it sounds like is you guys are providing similarly to them, obviously different kind of initiatives, but mentorship, guidance, and yep. the ability for people to experience life through other people's experiences, mm-hmm. not their own, so they can choose a different path.
Yes.
What does the follow-through look like there? Let's say I come to you.
Yeah.
And you're like, all right, let's get you hooked up with a mental health professional mm-hmm. first. What do you do next? I'm hooked up now. Are you guys following up? You call me? Are you checking in with me?
Yeah, we do. We do like a little checkup. Some people follow through. Some people don't.
Right.
We don't make it a thing to hinder or like the growth of a person, but we don't want to harass either.
Right.
So You know, we'll give you, like I said, we'll give you the tools, but you know, if I call you three times and all three times you told me, hey man, you know, I didn't really feel like it or something came up. My thing is you probably don't want to change. You know, I think maybe you thought you did, but you just don't want to put in the work to change. And so, you know, if you want to come back at a later date, by all means, but I'm not going to harass you and bully you into going. So that's what the follow-up kind of looks like. It's like, hey, man, is everything cool? Or they'll give us a call. Like, hey, listen, man, thank you so much. I really appreciate what you did. They got me in line with this therapist. That guy was working, but then I got referred to this guy who deals in this specific area of, and then they go from there.
Mm-hmm. I made a post the other day that said, plant the seed, water the seed, fertilize the soil, but never force growth upon something that doesn't see the benefit in growth.
Yes. I love that.
We have to do more than just plant seeds. But eventually it becomes, maybe that plant isn't better off growing right now. It should, but now the environment around that plant today, not suitable for growth.
Mm-hmm.
So how much of what you all are doing includes exercise and nutrition?
A great amount of it. I think it's geared because Frank was told to take like meds. Mm-hmm. And he felt that.
We've all been told to take meds.
Yeah, it's like he said he felt better when he just moved his body. So he's a big advocate of like holistic treatment and just moving your body and putting the right things in your body. That's why we're aligned with the nutritionist, and that's why they sponsor people who come to us with gym memberships. Mm-hmm. Say, listen, man. If you can commit to 365 days membership, we'll get you in this gym. We'll get you moving your body. And that's everything from CrossFit to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Oh, that's cool.
So, you know, just giving people different outlets to move and do things. I mean, setting you up to succeed. All you have to do is just kind of follow through. So on all different levels, you know, hey, maybe lifting weights isn't your thing, but Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is. Hey, we'll get you in there rolling on the mats.
Mm-hmm.
You go from there.
Yeah, healthy mind, healthy body. Healthy body, healthy mind. And the other thing, one of the things I find about exercise, and one of the reasons I do it, even when I don't feel like doing it, is because I can't mentally be anywhere else if I'm attacking that workout the way it's intended to be attacked.
Yeah.
And just having that 30 sometimes to 80-minute reprieve from my thoughts allows me, like, I do most of my best creative work right after a workout because my mind has been off of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the
same
reason
way. I do it. Same way, man. I have to move my body.
Yeah.
If I don't, it's just, I'm not saying it's a horrible day, but even if I get like a good walk in or something, I just got to do something for half hour, 45 minutes, and I'm good. You know, just keeps me in the right mentals.
Well, you're in the fitness space too. I mean, you train. Yes. So, and you're coaching football. So one of the things that I think people in the fitness space make a huge mistake to do, and I'm curious your opinion on whether this is a mistake or not. Maybe I shouldn't have planted the seed and just told you what I think. One of the mistakes I think we run into is we look at people who need to be more healthy. They're overweight. They have some weakness, whatever the case is. And the thought is exercise and eat right. Exercise and eat right. And my thought is, yeah, absolutely. When that's top of mind. Because the way I picture somebody, anybody, is we're all laying on our own proverbial bed of nails.
Mm-hmm.
And that person's bed of nails might not be the way that their body looks or feels.
Yeah.
It could be, I'm working two jobs and still not making enough money. It could be, I come home to a household where it's just not healthy.
Yeah.
It could be, I don't know how to think about my thoughts. And for that person, you're like, yo, just eat right and exercise. They're like, yeah, fuck you.
Yeah.
Right? So we don't have to start them there. We can start that person with maybe go talk to somebody.
Yes.
And the going and talking to somebody can allow them to eventually decide, okay, I have enough value that I will work out for 10 minutes a day.
Yeah.
And instead of that cupcake, I'll eat that apple.
Yeah.
I'm curious your thoughts on that as we're speaking to a large percentage of fitness professionals.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in 100% agreeance with you with what you just mentioned. I feel like a lot of people try to flick the switch instead of turn the dial. Mm-hmm. So you can't go from, like, Rome wasn't built overnight, right? It was over a gradual period of time. Rome became this vast and powerful empire. You can't start with, you know, something that might work for you or I. It, like you said, it's not going to work for somebody else. So it's small changes. I'm a big Kobe Bryant guy, and it's like 1% better every single day. And if you make small changes, that will eventually lead to big results. You can't just flick the switch. You got to just kind of turn the dial up ever so slowly. And I always tell people, sometimes, you know, being rooted in some kind of discipline or having some kind of routine, start with that, right? So maybe waking up in the morning and committing 10 minutes of breath work or something like this, just small shit. And then eventually that becomes bigger. And then that grows, and then that grows on top of that, and it becomes layered, and then now you start to get rooted into this positive behavior. I think too many people just try to, like, hey, this worked for me, just flick the switch. Mm-hmm. No, man, some people need to turn the dial.
Well, it's also, I've been in that camp. Hey, do this, I did this, it was great.
Yeah.
And what has been pointed out to me by people who are able to observe me better than I can, mm-hmm. is you thought about that for a year and a half.
Yeah.
Before you did something about it. Mm-hmm. You're asking that person to hear it and do something.
Yeah.
The same day. It sounds easy for you to say because you did do it.
Yeah.
Right? In my case, I was working 80 to 90 hour weeks every week. Mm-hmm. I was an absent husband, and my wife was concerned I was going to be an absent father. Mm. And so she came to me and she said, hey, I'm not interested in being a single mom. And she wasn't talking about leaving me. Mm-hmm. Right? My wife has been the greatest support I can ask for. She was talking about me being around. And I don't just mean physically, being there when I'm there.
Yeah.
And I was working all those hours, but I was making less than 30 grand a year. Wow. And I was chasing my ass. I didn't know anything about anything.
Yeah.
And so I hired a mentor when it finally got so painful that I couldn't not. Hired a mentor I couldn't afford. And he was like, if you want to be more successful, you just got to be a better person. I was like, I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
I'm great. I treat everybody exactly how I would want them to treat me. Yeah. He said, yeah, but you're a fucking psychopath. And people don't like being treated like a fucking psychopath does.
Yeah.
And I knew he wasn't being negative. He was just describing, like, I see something, I go. Yeah. That's it. I'll find out later. And so I when I talk to people now, it's important. I have to refocus oftentimes because I'm like, dude, this was all I needed to hear.
Yeah.
But the truth is I had to hear it after 2 years of really intense struggle. And they might not be there yet.
Yeah.
I heard a great statistic, and I don't remember exactly the number, but it was about Steph Curry because you talked about Kobe Bryant. It was something along the lines of he's shot over 2 million shots in practice, mm-hmm. because he takes this many shots a day, whatever it is. In his NBA career, he's taken this many shots.
Yeah.
And made this many shots. He took 99.99% of the shots in his life outside of a game. So that the 0.01% he takes in the game,
yep.
have a higher likelihood of being successful.
Yes. You see, that's why I love those kind of stats, because that's why I say being a creature of habit, man, just... Because now when he gets into a high-stress situation, this is the shot he's made 1,000 times. And so now it normalizes that high-stress situation to him is just another day, mm-hmm. shooting his shots. And I try to live my life like that. Like, Kobe was huge on that shit. They said Kobe would put up like 500 shots before a game. Mm-hmm. And there was one game where he missed a shot from the corner, came off a screen. Normally it's a shot that he hits. They said that night he shot 200 shots. From that shot, from that spot, post game. And that's what I try to preach to people. Just be a creature of habit, man. Just it's these little things. And if you're rooted, if you commit yourself to being better every single day, and it's small things, but eventually those lead to bigger things, then it becomes the norm. And that's exactly what you just mentioned. This man took millions of shots. But when, you know, if I got a game on the line, I want Steph Curry taking a shot because he's put himself in that position.
Mm-hmm. It's tapping the bar again.
That's all it is. That's it.
You said two things that made me think of this. Have you ever heard of how Gino Auriemma figures out which of his women should be on the court in the last 2 minutes?
No.
So you know who he is?
Yeah.
So for people who don't know, he's the winningest women's basketball coach of all time, UConn. I believe. He's definitely won the most national championships at UConn. Every player on his team is an All-American. They can all do the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he recruits for character. So they're high-character All-Americans, every girl. In practice, at the end of practice, they run pressure drills.
Mm-hmm.
And pressure drills are things like, we're all going to take a free throw. And as soon as everybody on the team hits a free throw consecutively without anyone missing, practice is over. But if one person misses, we keep going.
I like that.
And so what he does is he keeps track of the women. He's like, some women will make it every time when they're number 1 through 5.
Yeah.
But if they're number 9 through 12, they ain't making the shot. And sometimes they're the best player on the team. And so in the last 2 minutes, sometimes the best player on the team is on the bench.
Yep.
Because they're great the rest of the time, but not in those moments.
I like that.
It's interesting.
I'm going to have to implement something like that during football season.
There you go.
Figure something out.
Yeah. I really appreciate you coming out here and chatting about this today because it's one of these topics that you are a man's man, right? You're a good athlete. You're a police officer. You played football. You're a strong CrossFitter. It's easy for someone to look at you and be like, yeah, guys got it together. And I think you do. And it's because you've worked at it.
Yeah.
And it's necessary for people to hear that message so that they can decide that it's okay also for them to work at it.
I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Is there anything that you think would be useful for the audience that I didn't ask you about, but they should know?
No, man. I feel like you covered all bases, man. This was a phenomenal conversation. I think we touched on some great points. And just I have a great deal of respect for you because your insight is you look at things in a lens that I don't see it. So seeing it from your angle, to me, just kind of opens up my eyes to different avenues on how I can view or attack certain situations. Mm-hmm. So that's why I was super intrigued by, like, sitting down and having this conversation. I knew, I was like, this guy's going to ask me things, and it's going to really rewire how I think on certain situations.
I appreciate that.
Anytime, man.
All right. Turn pro. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Active Life Podcast. Please remember, give us a hand, rate it, review it wherever you listen to shows. We are on a mission to humanize the healthcare industry by professionalizing the fitness industry to empower the individual to live a life unlimited by the way that their body looks, feels, or performs. If you are inspired by that mission and want to jump on the wagon, find us anywhere. Active Life Professional on Instagram, Active Life RX on Instagram. Come to me personally at Dr. Sean Pestuch. We want to welcome you onto the train. We want you to be a part of the mission. We want to offer you the opportunity to pursue this right alongside us. We're inspired by your effort, and we hope to help you in your journey. Turn back.